from meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news. Broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at scaredmonkeysradio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. We've got a busy night ahead of us. My next guest, you'll know Clint Van Zandt, is a retired FBI agent, author, profiler. I thought I'd bring him back again this week. We've got a lot more to talk about. Of course, the Fort Hood massacre. There's a serial killer that they've caught in Cleveland, all sorts of things. I want you to check out Clint's webpage, livesecure.org. It's all redone. It's interactive. Whoever does his webpage work did a great job. Hi, Clint. Welcome back.
Hey, good evening, Dana. Thanks.
I got to give you kudos to whoever did your webpage. It looks great.
I know we were very fortunate. My oldest son is a copywriter. He's in the ad business, and he had a friend who was willing to work with us. And, you know, you and I sometimes are on kind of shoestring budgets, and somebody who was willing to put in a lot of time for very little money and just did a wonderful job. So it just they just keep improving it every day, something far above my ability to do, but I do have the ability to appreciate it.
Absolutely. It looks great, too. Now, yeah, you're also writing articles on Newsvine, and we've got the link in the show notes for that. And we want to start with Fort Hood. Now, not only are you, retired FBI, law enforcement, all that, but you spent some time in the military, too. This is a tragedy, Clint.
Well, it is, and as you say, you know, I was a Army intelligence agent. I served the tour of duty in Vietnam, so, you know, even though that's been quite a while ago, I can still appreciate this. In fact, I was on television tonight, and I've been so angry, Dana, this last week with television, The media just pussyfooting around, calling this shooter what I believe he is, and what I said blatantly on television tonight when I was asked, what do you think you have? And I said, this guy is a terrorist.
Yep.
He is a radicalized Islamic fundamentalist who used his distorted view of his religion as his reason to be a terrorist. And I said, he's just as much of a terrorist as Timothy McVeigh is when he blew up the Oklahoma City Federal Building. I said, this is someone who did it with premeditation. He bought the first of his weapons, the 5.7 millimeter, called a cop killer round, because when you use the appropriate rounds, it'll punch through a police officer's bullet-resistant vest. And he had one with a laser sight, and that's the primary weapon that he used, as well as, you know, a .357 Magnum revolver. And I said, this is a guy who the U.S. government paid his way all the way through med school, so we thought he owed us something. But we are so politically correct, nobody wanted to take him on when he was making these outrageous statements about taking joy when a U.S. recruiter was blown up or shot down last year, and the many other statements attributed to him, which suggest the radicalized belief system that he had. And I said, besides, the U.S. military wanted to hold on to him because he was a psychiatrist and they need it. But I said, all of that still doesn't get away from the guy as a terrorist, and you have to call it as you see it. And when we become so politically correct that we're blinded, political correctness then becomes the handmaiden for terrorists, as far as I'm concerned.
Absolutely. Could you imagine during wartime in the 40s, 50s, whatever, someone swearing allegiance to Hitler or to the Nazi Party?
Yeah, I mean, just see that. Someone, you know, if you had a major in the U.S. Army raising his right hand to Hitler, how would that have gone over?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I guarantee you, not very well. And this country better get its act together and better understand. You know, we've got 3,500 members of the U.S. military that are Muslims, and I'm sure 99.5% are wonderful men and women.
Yep.
And are doing their job and are able to make the differentiation between their religious belief systems and their duty to this country and their duty to the military. But, see, a guy like this major is, you know, he has been on Al-Qaeda's Christmas wish list for years. We know year after year Al-Qaeda has been looking to try to find a way to radicalize members of the American military and get them to strike out from the inside. This guy is a major. He is the absolute Christmas gift for Al-Qaeda, and all we have to be careful of is understand, let's call him what he is, let's understand what he is, let's know that he did it with premeditation, let's know that there's not a mental aberration here, there's not a mental illness. He did it purposefully, he planned on doing it, and let's separate him from the rank and file of 1.3 billion Muslims in the world and say that, just like BBC Radio did a survey, Dana, and they came back and they said about 10% of the Muslims in the world support the activities of attacking non-Muslims and killing them. Well, you do the numbers, 10% of 1.3 billion people is still a significant number of people. This guy is probably the fringe of the fringe who would act out in the way that he did. But there are others out and about like that, and the U.S. government and the U.S. military has got to have a way to find these people, sit them down and say, what are you up to? And if the answers don't jive with the statements and their activities, we've got to get them out of sensitive positions and get them away from where they can hurt us.
Absolutely. Political correctness, it's costing lives for sure. And Clint's article on Newsvine.com, ClintVanZant.Newsvine.com, check it out and others. We talked about it earlier before on different shows. It's a couple of local cops here that saved the day. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, and there really is. And that's, once again, Dana, political correctness. When this story first broke, and realize these were two civilian cops, male and a female, who were the first responders. These were cops who were civilian police, Department of Defense employees on the base. They got the call, shots fired. They were the first two that responded. The female officer who went in, she engaged the subject. They started exchanging rounds back and forth. She was hit multiple times and went down. The second male police officer was on the scene at that time. The subject was still up and shooting. The male officer then engaged this guy and hit him multiple times and finally put the major, the shooter, the killer, the murderer, finally put him down. Well, we were so desperate in this country to have a hero that everything was said about the female officer, and rightfully so. She was a hero. She stood there and duked it out and threw rounds downrange at this guy. But the male officer who finally put him down, his name, Dana, initially didn't even get mentioned. It reminded me a few years ago of that in Iraq, the American female private who was taken prisoner and was held in an Iraqi hospital. And we sent special ops teams in, and they rescued her, got her out of the hospital. And the military built her up to be this. She was slinging lead at the bad guys, and she emptied all of her magazines and went down fighting before she was hit. She finally said, and rightfully so, she said, you know what, my gun jammed on the first round, and I never fired a bullet.
Yeah.
But that doesn't make any difference, because every man and woman in the military and in law enforcement should be our heroes. But we shouldn't have to manufacture them. We should just call them what they are.
Clint Van Zant's here, and we're talking about the Fort Hood massacre. I want to get back to the political correctness part of it and the military for a minute. Here you have an individual, Hassan. He gets to the rank of major. He's counseling those coming back from Iraq. The media, again, like you say, and I was so angry too, are trying to blame his upcoming tour of duty. I think in Afghanistan he was supposed to go to, or maybe Iraq,
right.
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
And he was so terrified that that this was his way to act out. And if I could have crawled through the TV and choked that commentator, I would have.
I would have too. I mean, when I see these lily-livered commentators rolling out this so far left liberal crap, excuse me, that there comes a time where you got to say, let the chips fall where they may and call it what it is. If it's wrong on the left, if it's wrong on the right, let's call it that and let it be. But instead, right away you heard them starting to build up this psychological defense for this guy, saying, he did it because he listened to the war stories of a number of troops coming back.
Mm-hmm.
And when he heard those war stories. It was kind of a post-traumatic stress incident, and that's what caused him to do it. Ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. The guy had never been in a combat zone in his life. He listened to the story of others. That didn't make him do it. And when they say, well, he did it because he was going to have to go to Afghanistan and kill his fellow Muslims, Dana, the guy's a medical doctor. He wasn't going to strap on a gun and go out. What he was going to do was be in a position to do just what he did in the United States, to counsel U.S. military and Afghani's military who were engaged, who had experienced post-traumatic stress. He would have been in a position to continue to help both Americans and Afghanis and Muslims, and he chose not to do it. This is a guy who let the U.S. government, after 9/11, let the U.S. government pay $500,000 to $1 million to send him all the way through medical school. He finally gets his ultimate degree, and all of a sudden he starts having pangs of conscience about being a Muslim and feels that he should be let out of the military as a conscientious objector. Mm-hmm. And strangely enough, the U.S. government said, you know what, you signed a contract, you're supposed to stay here till 2016, and therefore we're going to hold you to that contract. And this is the way this guy acted out, Dana. He wanted to make a statement. He wanted to make a religious, political statement, and unfortunately, he wrote it in the blood of American GIs.
Yeah, it's just tragedy for sure. Another article on Newsvine that you've written so well, and of course you've seen this, you've dealt with them yourself. Of course, the serial killer so well in Cleveland. Again, something that I don't think we've heard the end of. Let's talk about him.
Yeah, and this is an interesting case, too. You know, as you know, this is a serial killer who's been active in Cleveland for a number of years. This is a guy who did, you know, he was a former U.S. Marine. He did about 6 years in the Marines. He was subsequently arrested for a very brutal rape that he did. He did 15 years in state prison. And as soon as he got out of prison, he started hunting again. But, you know, like a lot of guys in prison, he just kind of refined what he did, and he learned a lesson, Dana. And the lesson was he went to jail for 15 years because he let his victim live. He learned in Cleveland all he's got to do is kill the victims, and he doesn't go back to jail, at least not for a while. So for the last 4 or 5 years, it's believed that he's been killing women. And like many predators, he has a particular area that he swims or operates in. Now, the guy doesn't drive a car. He takes a bus back and forth. But when he's out and about, he's living in a relatively poor economic area, and he's using booze and drugs to get women to come into his house that he lives in now by himself. He would sexually assault them. He would, in some cases, quickly choke, and in other cases, very slowly choke his victims to death, because I think he enjoyed when they were dying. And then some bodies he buried, but I think near the end, just before he was arrested, Dana, I think he was decompensating so that he was just leaving the bodies laying out. So we know the guy is good for at least probably 12 homicides right now in Cleveland, but where this investigation is now going worldwide, because we know, of course, in the Marine Corps, he was stationed in North Carolina. He's lived in 2 or 3 other states, as well as he was in Okinawa. So the FBI is attempting to construct a timeline. They're looking at a timeline to figure out where he was in given years, and then they're looking at the unsolved homicides that took place in the same area at the same time to try to figure out how many this guy is good for. I mean, there are some suggestions, depending on the unsolved crimes in Cleveland and the nearby area and other states, he's good for 12, we know, within the house. The bodies have been found. He could easily be good for another dozen before this whole situation is resolved.
Why do they keep the bodies? You know, some do, some don't, but is it a trophy? Is it that he just doesn't want to let the evidence out? Is it something for him to remember? What's the reason?
In his particular case, I think it was more of a matter of convenience, Dana. I think it was he didn't drive, so unlike a Ted Bundy who would use his car to transport his victims from point A to point B and dispose of the body. Like many serial killers will have a a pre-designated body disposal site where they know they're going to take and dump the body. This is a guy who, because of his mental condition and everything else, he didn't mind soiling his own sandbox, so to speak. It was easy to get the women off the street in the neighborhood. It was easy to get them in his house. It was easy to kill them there. And because he didn't necessarily have the means of moving the body from point A to point B, he just kept them there. Initially, I think he buried them in the backyard. He buried them in the basement. But as time went on, it was a combination of, I think, a psychological decompensation where he was just losing it. And number two, he probably thought, it doesn't make any difference. I don't even have to hide the bodies. Nobody really cares. So I think as he went on, as many killers will refine what they do, I think he just believed that he was, in fact, he told one woman who survived a sexual assault, he used words to the effect of, you're just a junkie, you're just an alky in a poor neighborhood. Nobody's going to miss you, and nobody's going to believe what you say anyway. And the terrible thing was, Dana, that's the group he was preying on. And in all honesty, when you get into an environment like that, many times those people aren't missed. He was dealing with victims who would be gone days and maybe weeks at a time and who weren't accountable to anybody else. So their children, their significant others, it may be a month or more before they really knew that their mother, their sister, whoever it was actually missing because they didn't come home every night. Well, then you report a missing person to police, to an inner city police department that's overworked. They're used to, one woman suggested the police department said to her when she reported her mother missing, they said, well, you know, we know she's a junkie or an alky, so whenever the drugs run out, she'll come home again. Well, I mean, that was a terrible thing to say, but the bottom line is it's a reality in the inner city many times, and when police officers are dealing with these type of missing person reports, I think it's true. They just don't necessarily get the attention. You and I know when you're dealing with someone who's missing or murdered, if you have a high-risk victim, somebody engaged in drug, alcohol, prostitution, when they're functioning in a high-risk neighborhood and when they're doing high-risk things, when you start to tie all that together, that's a formula for murder, and that's what happened to a lot of these women.
Absolutely. Nobody's looking for them. Take us into the mind, Clint, in our last few minutes here, of a Sowell, of a Major Hassan, of a BTK, of a, you know, someone who's premeditating, someone who's planning whether they're going to go out and avow revenge on all the infidels, or they're just going to go out and kill hookers, or what they're going to do.
Well, different reasons, Dana, and you know that as well as I. When we're talking about the serial killer in Cleveland Sowell, this is someone who, again, a sociopath, a psychopath, an antisocial personality, somebody who, in his own way, saw himself as the sun and the rest of us were the moon or the stars, but he was the primary mover there. And when you have those sociopathic tendencies, when you believe that all you need is instant gratification for yourself, and you cannot identify with the pain that others suffer, when you don't feel the condemnation of society for what you might be doing, you can imagine any of us, if we could be devoid of any social or psychological or religious or political constraints whatsoever, if we could just do anything we wanted to anybody, what would we be capable of? Well, in society, about 2-4% of any societal body are sociopaths, psychopaths, antisocial personalities. Now, they're not all serial killers like Soils is. In fact, you know, some of them are captains of industry. Some of them have probably been presidents of the United States in the past, too. But they're not committing murders, but they're doing other type of activities that they don't really feel responsible for. And they don't have a sense of responsibility. But when you get to somebody like Major Hassan, this again is when you have someone who takes that religious belief system. And remember, there was a lot of things going on with this guy. He was kind of shy. He was a little bit backwards, even though he was an MD. He wanted a wife as bad as anybody has ever wanted a woman in his life, I think. But he wanted a burqa-wearing Muslim woman who was stronger in her faith than even he was. And the, you know, the ponds he went to fishing for that type of woman, they just weren't stocked with that person that he was looking for. And I think he was frustrated in his ability at his age to identify a woman that he could share, a partner that he can share his life with. And then I think he wound up on some of these radicalized websites and his dealings with other individuals. And somehow that all thinking, that concept got distorted in him, and he believed the rhetoric. In fact, one web posting he put out, Dana, he suggested that the victorious Muslim soldier would be the one who would find 100 enemy soldiers who weren't aware or weren't alert, and then he was able to go in and kill them all. That would be victory. Well, when you look at that web posting and you look at what he did, he walks into this medical facility, he jumps up with his 5.7 semi-automatic and the 357 Magnum revolver, yells Allah Akbar, and then just starts mowing down. And Dana, he's killing men and women, yeah. He's killing young and old, he's killing black, he's killing white, he's killing Hispanic, he killed a pregnant woman. He didn't care who, because he wasn't aiming at people, he was aiming at that green uniform, and he felt everyone was the same, in essence, different than him. Was this guy, you know, people are going to say, well, he was harassed because of his faith. Dana, he was a major in the United States Army. You don't harass majors in the United States Army.
Yeah, that's...
So, you know, don't hide behind that shield. Don't hide behind the political correctness. I think the only thing he failed to do in his master plan was to die. I think he really wanted to martyr himself, and he figured that he would kill as many as he could, and he would die. Well, he's lived, and now it's going to be interesting to see what defense he comes up with to explain the unexplainable mass murder.
Absolutely. Clint Van Zandt, his new improved website, livesecure.org, and you can check out his articles at clintvanzandt.newsvine.com. Thanks, Clint. Always a pleasure.
Thanks for having me, Dana. Okay. Good night.
Bye-bye. That's Dr. Clint Van Zandt, and when I say doctor, yeah, he's got a master's degree. He's been around and around and around. He can tell stories that you and I could only think about, and he's been involved in them. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. My name's Dana Pretzer. We're going to continue on talking about Sowell and the serial killer and the major who did the shooting at Fort Hood with criminal profiler Pat Brown. That's here in a couple of minutes on Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. Pat Brown, criminal profiler, is with me. She is on the line. Hi, Pat. Hello, Pat.
Hello. Hey, how you doing, Tim?
That's okay. How are you doing, by the way? You're with somebody who's coming on next, aren't you?
I'm right here right now, and Robin will be on the next round.
Robin, and you're both in D.C.?
We are both in D.C. sitting at the same table at the fine Cafe Milano in Georgetown, D.C.
Wow.
So we're enjoying each other's company.
What are you doing there, by the way?
Robin was here to accept a wonderful award for her fabulous work with children who have been abused, and I accompanied her to her event tonight, and so we got to spend the day together.
That's quite nice. I thought maybe she was getting an award for filling out the, or for finally figuring out the health care plan that Obama had put out.
I don't think anyone's going to be getting an award for that, let me say.
Listen, my first guest and I talked about it. Now I'm going to talk about it with you and with Robin a little bit later on. We're going to talk about Fort Hood and then a little bit about Anthony Sowell right after that. First of all, your thoughts on the major and Fort Hood and the tragedy that is.
Well, I think, you know, a lot of people are going crazy about whether he's a terrorist or whether he's not a terrorist. And a lot of people think if you say he's not a terrorist that you're being, like, politically correct. Well, I think, you know, Dana, I'm probably one of the most politically incorrect people around. Never gave a darn what people thought about, you know, whether I'm politically correct or not. I try to speak the truth. I'll tell you right now, I think Hassan is not a terrorist. I think he is a mass murderer. And I'll tell you why. Did he develop himself with an ideology of violent Islamic jihadist? Yes, he did.
Yeah.
But that has nothing to do with the fact that he's a terrorist. A terrorist is somebody who works for a terrorist organization, who plans a particular attack. I've been in India, spent a lot of time there, been up in Kashmir, and I can tell you, there are terrorist attacks there run by, like, say, Lakshya Toiba or Fuji, and they plan the attacks out, and they send their members out to do it, and those members then enact the terrorist attack. This was not the case with Hassan. Hassan wasn't connected with anyone. He was a psychopath who was in midlife crisis, and he could have been a Christian, he could have been a Jew, he could have been anything. But what happened to him was he was failing in his life, failing in his personal life. He couldn't get a lady. He kept trying to get them to get him somebody, but none of the women appealed to him, and none of the women probably liked him very much. And he was failing in his job. He was failing with his. He wasn't very so having any success in his social life. So he was having major problems, like every other midlife crisis to mass murderer that we see. But the thing is, when a mass murderer decides to go out and enact his crime, he likes to have a justification for it. So if you're a teenage mass murderer going to attack a school, you're going to say, those people bullied me.
Mm-hmm.
You go on the internet and you'll talk with people, get together with them and say, yeah, those people at school, they're all a bunch of bullies and we're downtrodden. And that gives you your justification. But that's not your motive. Your motive is to kill the people that you just, you know, you're pissed off at, and you want to say, hey, you ignored me, you thought I was nobody, I'm going to show you. And that's what midlife crisis guys do as well. Sometimes they kill their wife and children, but sometimes they go out and do one of these workplace violence things and say, look, you know, you disrespected me, didn't give me the time of day, now I'm going to take you all out. That's what Hassan was. Now, he developed his, he was a Muslim, so he developed Muslim ideology to back his plan so he could feel good about himself. So he could say, oh, I'm a good Muslim, and that's what I'm doing a good thing here. That's all in his little psychopathic mind, but he was not connected to any kind of organization who helped him along and instructed him and did anything with him. So was he a mass murderer? Yes. Was he a horrible killer? Yes. Did he have radical Islamic thinking in his head? Of course he did. But that doesn't make him a terrorist attached to any organization. And we do have to be concerned in our country about the development of terrorist cells. I'm all for that. And do I think the army screwed up royally and that they didn't toss this guy out? Do I think they were being too politically correct by not tossing out a guy just because he was Muslim?
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Yep.
But still, it doesn't make him a terrorist.
No, I agree. And whether he's you want to call him a terrorist or a mass murderer, it's tragic. But let's go into the mind, and I think of some of these guys. Pat, you make a very good point. You know, the office shootings that we see, whether it's a midlife crisis, whether it's a serial killer like Sowell or this major that's gone nuts. Why do people do this? Like, what drives them?
Well, all serial killers and all mass murderers come with a psychopathic nature, that they're very angry that they've never succeeded in life the way they wanted to succeed. Now, mind you, they're usually so obnoxious and so narcissistic and self-centered that they cause their own downfall. But they're never going to admit that, because they themselves are always right and everybody else is always wrong. So a serial killer, by the time he's already a teen, is a psychopath, and he's developing his hatred. And he might target, for example, women. And he'll say, oh, those women all deserve to die. It has nothing to do with women. It has to do with the fact that he wants to kill people, make himself feel good, feel like he's God for a minute, and he's going to attack women because they're, simple fact, they're smaller packages than he is, and he can control them. But a mass murderer, they tend to be either teenagers or midlife crisis guys. So the teenagers have already figured out that there's nothing in life ahead of them. They hate everything. They hate the parents. They hate the system. They hate the school. They hate all those popular kids. So they go out, they decide they're going to have this moment where they're going to become famous. And they indeed do accomplish that, and their names go down in history. Midlife crisis, same thing, gotten to this point, I'm nobody, I'm never going to be anybody, and even though this guy was a psychiatrist, his son was a psychiatrist, but he was going downhill rapidly. So he says, look, you know, I know what's left in front of me, which is nothing good. I'm being transferred over to Fort Hood, which is an insult to me. I'm never going to be anything. So I'm going to go down in history. I want my name out there. I want to be famous. And he has achieved this. He's an anti-hero, even if he considers himself a hero. But he's going to go down in history. And that's all he was wanting to accomplish. It was a personal vendetta and a personal goal. It had nothing to do with terrorism. In fact, he wanted to accomplish anything for any group or any real political ideology.
Pat Brown's here. She's a criminal profiler, author, crime commentator, victims advocate, you name it. She happens to be in Washington, D.C. tonight, where Robin Sachs is getting an award, and we'll talk to Robin a little bit later on in the show. Let's go to Cleveland now. Anthony Sowell, we hear about the serial killers here. We've got another one, a whole stack of bodies in his house. Who knows where else he's been and who else he's killed. It's going to be a big story, more to hear about it. Your thoughts on Sowell?
Yeah, Anthony Sowell, yes, you're absolutely correct. He went to jail when he was about 30 years old for the what he was considered an attempted rape. That's what he pled down to, but fact is, he raped the woman, he kidnapped her, he was attempting to murder her when she escaped. Essentially, he was a serial killer at that moment, but he got a much prettier title when he pled down. But you can't tell me that somebody was running around 30 years not committing any crime. So my guess is Sowell's time in the Army, if you go back to find out where he was stationed, you're going to find some raped women there and some dead women in those locations. So he was a serial killer way back. What was really sad about this was when he was released from prison, everybody knew where he was. But one of the problems we have with these labels is the parole officer goes out and he says to himself, this guy's just an attempted rapist.
Yeah.
No, he wasn't just an attempted rapist. Man is a serial killer. So when you start smelling bad smells behind that man, you know, when he's standing on the porch and that house doesn't smell exactly good, you ought to ask yourself, you know, this guy really is actually, in fact, a serial killer. Perhaps I ought to be checking out his house and see if he's been killing other women.
You know, and we've seen this with other cases. Almost called you Robin, Pat. Why do they keep the bodies in the houses with them?
Well, in Sowell's case, probably because he didn't have a vehicle.
Yeah.
I mean, serial killers are practical human beings. If they have a vehicle and they're used to cruising around and being able to select their victims by maybe finding a hitchhiker or picking up a prostitute on the strip and then taking her someplace, or just grabbing a schoolgirl off the street and driving off with her, they will rape her and dump her in the bushes someplace.
That's a good point.
But in this particular case, man didn't have a vehicle.
Yeah.
And he had this wonderful location, which was in a particular area of Cleveland that was low income, had a lot of drug use, a lot of prostitution, a lot of alcohol problems. So he says, you know, I know I've got victims just wandering down the street. And I don't even work. You know, I'm just here and I'm picking up some metal here and there. I don't work. I can stand on my porch. I can make nicey-nicey with a neighbor because he gave a barbecue at one point. I make nicey-nicey. And one day, when nobody's looking and I see this woman alone, and this is the window of opportunity, so no one's going to see that I grabbed the girl, I say to her, hey, babe, you want to have a drink? And she says, sure, because she has an alcohol problem. Well, he says, you want to have some, you know, I got some something for you here, some drugs. And she says, sure, cool, because a drug addict, unfortunately, will go pretty much any place to get those drugs. And if a woman's a prostitute, she will look for some money. So he had a great population to attack. Now, this doesn't mean that there couldn't have been a church woman rolling down the boulevard who was handing out pamphlets and trying to help people find Jesus. And he said, come on in and pray for me. And she did, because she thought he was just one of the nice men on the street. So she could have been a victim as well. But let's face it, he had a great group of women on the street to go for, because there were people that were easy to put a ploy on and get them in his house. And they when they went missing, unfortunately, when the families, some of the family, one family didn't even report that their loved one went missing because she had so much problems that they thought, oh, she just went off with somebody, one of her boyfriends. And they didn't even report her that she went missing. But the ones that were reported to the police, probably the problem is the police are so inundated with cases. They have so many cases, rape cases, homicides, burglary cases. Somebody comes in and says, oh, my loved one is missing. And they're like, yeah, well, what does this loved one do? Let me check out who they are. Oh, man, they got a rap sheet a mile long.
Yep.
And they're like, okay, this person got drug problems. They'll show back up again. And usually they do. So the police do not have the manpower or the funding to go running after every missing person in that location.
Yep.
Now, what's unfortunate is, I would like to see what's called a suspected serial homicide unit in every police department. But they at least log in and, you know, pinpoint where these women are on a computer. So if you start to see a little ring around Sowell's house, you might get a little suspicious that missing people didn't just go missing on their own. Perhaps somebody helped them out.
Yeah, you're right. And if nobody's looking for them, you know, they're going to be missing for quite some time. But Pat, I want you to comment on, just in our last few minutes here with you, some of these serial killer cases in the past, BTK, the DC sniper is going to be meeting his Waterloo here pretty quick, and even going back to what's his name there in San Francisco, how they like to tease the media, how they like to tease the police, call to radio stations, write letters to TV stations, try to get some attention brought to them to keep their story alive, so to speak. Why do they do that?
Case, most serial killers actually do not do this. Most serial killers simply want to kill, get their moment of thrill, and go back into the community. Sowell didn't contact anybody. He was one of those traditional serial killers who really doesn't have anything to do with the media or the police. They want to lay low.
Right.
So we have that kind of, since it really is a rarity, but when it does hit the media, of course, we're going to focus on it. In the case of BTK, the original BTK, which personally I don't think was Dennis Rader, I have an issue with that because there was no DNA actually in that case to match Dennis Rader. Part of the fact the prosecution claims there was, I know there isn't for a fact because I worked with the detectives in that case on one of the suspects, and they said there was no DNA. But that guy did send in something, but it's very rare. And yeah. Muhammad actually sent in one too, because at that point he was mocking, because Muhammad was more of a spree killer, and was kind of, he knew he was going to work himself into eventually getting killed, so he was enjoying the thrill out of teasing everybody and having everybody race after him. So he was very unusual. So we can't expect that from very many serial killers. Most of them, actually, we don't even know they exist. Like Green River Killer, we didn't know existed. Well, we knew he was out there, but when they finally caught up with him 30 years later, there was no communication, you know, with the media. He just did what he did.
Yeah, you're right. It is rare, and in most situations, it's the media that makes the most of it. And you're so right when it comes to BTK. That guy is famous. He's got more media coverage here, and that's what he wants.
Well, Dennis Rader is a serial killer. Dennis Rader did commit some of the later crimes.
Yeah.
It's my belief that Dennis Rader committed a crime after 1990 when he would have gotten the death penalty. And because they wanted to put him, they wanted to close down all these cases, simply he just confessed to all of them. And to this day, prosecutors have not shown one shred of evidence that he committed the earlier BTK crime. I don't believe he was the original BTK. He was the later guy.
That's interesting. Besides his mass confession, there isn't much there.
Absolutely nothing. They have refused to come forth with anything publicly to show that he was connected to those crimes.
Let's finish up with your thoughts on our mutual friend and colleague Robin Sachs.
What?
Tell me your thoughts about Robin and the award she won tonight.
Oh, that's really very special. Robin really got a really rousing crowd tonight. They're just so thrilled the fact that she's put so much effort into her concern about children who are victims of sex crimes and also sex workers. And, you know, in other words, that children go out there, they're abused and used. And this organization really appreciated it. She'll tell you more about that, how, you know, they're so thrilled that she's brought this to light publicly. And especially since she does a lot of media work now, she's able to bring this to the forefront to the American public. And I think it's just fabulous.
Well, that's great, and it's fantastic you're there with her. Thank you, Pat. I appreciate it.
All right. Thanks a lot, Dana.
Talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
All right.
That's criminal profiler Pat Brown, and she's in Washington, D.C. with Robin Sachs, who's getting an award, and we're going to talk about that here in a few minutes. My name's Dana Pretzer. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. I remind you that our webpage is www.scaredmonkeysradio.com. There you can listen to the show live. You can pick up podcasts of past shows. You can listen to my daily commentary, leave comments. And, of course, one of the best blogs that's out there is scaredmonkeys.com. And there you can check out all the fine work that Class and Red and others do, and check out the forum and you name it. And Red's got an excellent article about this Major Hassan and the Fort Hood shooting, the tragedy of it, and the political correctness involved. And that's why I try to get differing opinions on the program. You get Clint Van Zandt and Pat Brown basically saying the same thing, but basically disagreeing on whether or not this is an act of terrorism. Was Timothy McVeigh a terrorist? Was this Major a terrorist? I'll let you decide and make your own opinion. But the tragedy of it is that there was a lot of political correctness. Sadly, there still will be political correctness with stories like this and other stories that will come in the future, sadly, and it's something with today's society that needs to be fixed. We're going to take a break, and we'll be right back here on the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. Okay, we're back. This is the Dana Pretzer Show. It's our weekly segment called Nothing But the Sacks with Robin Sachs, who happens to be where my last guest was. In fact, they're sitting very close to each other. She's in D.C., where she won an award for First Star, I believe. Robin, hi.
Hi there. Thank you for having me.
Tell us about the award, and congratulations, by the way.
Thank you. You know, First Star is an amazing organization. It really is an organization. It was a Shine the Light award, which is about shining the light on issues of child abuse. And really, they deal with things in a little bit different way than I think, Dana, you and I are used to. You and I are kind of used to people on a grassroots level advocating kind of one case at a time, one instance at a time of injustices. And this organization actually goes about making legislative change on a national level. by using the good old-fashioned report cards. If you remember your A, B, C's, D's, and F's from elementary and high school, what they do is they grade the states on how they're doing in terms of protecting kids by looking at states like, you know, New York gets an A while New Jersey gets a C, enforcing legislative change. And they spent some time honoring people who have spent time and, you know, for those of us who have spent time working on advocating on behalf of children, it was a wonderful honor, but it's, more importantly, it's a wonderful organization.
Yeah, it's fantastic, and congratulations. Now, I'm sitting here looking at a copy of your book, It Happens Every Day, Inside the World of a Sex Crimes DA, and I'm looking at your picture on the front of the book, nice picture, but Robin, you look pissed off in it. What's going on?
You know, it's really kind of funny. I'm happy you are talking to me about that picture because I was kind of annoyed with the picture because I do piss off. And there's a lot of pictures that I took during that photo shoot, actually, and some were silly and some were funny. Some of you have seen them on my Facebook page with me on a court bench, on the judge's bench, hanging from there laughing. But they told me that they didn't want me, my publishers, didn't want me to smile.
Yeah.
And truly, when you're representing It Happens Every Day and you're talking about the injustices in the criminal justice system with the representation of children and what happens from the child sexual assault, it is no laughing or smiling matter.
Exactly.
And so, hell, it's time to be pissed off. And I'm pissed off at some of the things that happen in our criminal justice system. So it was an appropriate picture for the book.
It's a great picture, and I'm teasing you, and for those that look at it, think, geez, I don't want to go up against her. Look at her. She looks just like she's going to go out for blood.
Yes. You got to take these matters seriously, and, you know, I coined this summer as the summer of missed opportunities.
Yeah.
And when I think about every case that we're dealing with, and we can look at it in the Hassan case, and we can look at it with so many cases, it's really, and things that we talk about every week on your amazing show, about the cases in which all the signs, the symptoms, the signals were there, and they were up for grabs for law enforcement, for DAs, for judges, for everybody who had a place to do something, and people just weren't doing anything about it. And frankly, that pisses me off.
Yep.
I'm tired of seeing cases where we look after the fact, after the case, after the person's in custody and say, gee, God, it's too bad that person killed all those people. We should have seen the signs. Or it's too bad that person molested all those people. We should have seen the signs. I mean, when are we going to start looking at these cases and seeing the signs and symptoms and doing something before all the damage is done?
Absolutely. Couldn't have said it better myself. And wouldn't it be fantastic to hear a story of how they prevented a mass shooting because of whatever? You know, call the Major Hassan, or disgrace Major Hassan, a terrorist, call him a mass murderer, call him whatever. There's a lot of people that blew it when it came to this guy, and he should have never got to this stage, correct?
Oh, I mean, in this case, I mean, we see it in a global, macro, huge level, and sometimes it's only when cases of huge recognition do we see these missed opportunities. But if I hear the words missed opportunities from some legal pundit one more time, I'm going to barf. I mean, the fact is that if these are missed opportunities, why are we missing the opportunities? And why are the people who are missing these opportunities promoting Hassan, allowing them to continue practicing in any way, and why aren't we doing something about it before they wreak havoc on people's lives? It's inexcusable, and if the signs and symptoms are there, why is it that we're not doing anything about it?
Absolutely. Robin Sachs is here. Check out her webpage at robinsachs.com. She's a former sex crimes prosecutor. She's an author, victims advocate, and a TV commentator when it comes to crime issues. And I couldn't be more gosh darn proud of someone than I am about her. Dr. Phil Monday, Joey Behar Wednesday. You're all over the place.
It's been a crazy life, I have to admit. One of the things that I saw when I left the DA's office, that instead of making a difference one case at a time, and as I've said before, once the people are within the criminal justice system, the damage is already done.
Yeah.
And so with shows like yours and platforms like Joe Behar, Dr. Phil, or any of those other people who do spend the time on these important issues, at least maybe someone will be listening to realize, hey, there's a problem, there's an issue, let's try to see these signs and symptoms and do something before someone else is victimized. And that's what this is about. You can make something and make a difference on such a more macro level in the media than you can in the criminal justice system, which is a sad thing to say about our criminal justice system, but I can go on TV and affect change better than I can in a courtroom. That's pathetic.
Yeah. No, you're right. And I want to talk a little bit to you about this political correctness issue. And I told my first guest tonight, Clint Van Zandt, I said, Clint, you know, I was listening to a commentator the other day talking about this Major Hassan and how it really happened because he didn't want to go and do a tour in Afghanistan and have to see his brother Muslims being killed. And I could have crawled through the TV and choked that commentator. So not only is there political correctness in the military and the courts or whatever, but it's in the media too, and it's so sickening. And for someone who's doing such good work in the media, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know what, it's time for us to call it, like, I mean, frankly, you know, it the good, the bad, the ugly. I mean, I have to tell you, just a few weeks ago we had the case of the balloon boy.
Yep.
and before we even knew that it was a hoax, when I was watching this case unfold, as many people were doing live on TV, I was quite frankly astonished. And mind you, at the moment, I thought it was a true righteous crime. But I'm sitting here thinking that Wolf Blitzer was in the Situation Room with his smart board, mapping out trajectories of where this silver balloon thing could fall down. And we sat there for hours watching the falling of this balloon. Now, and I'm thinking, how many crimes have just occurred during this moment of us watching this silver puffball that, you know, basically looks like Chef Boyardee's cap coming down? And those are the cases. And why is it that case made the media? Because it was a silver Chef Boyardee hat that was so fascinating? Was it because there was, sorry for the background noise, DC for you. Is it possible that it was because, you know, that it was an interesting case of a balloon that got away? I mean, what was it that made that case? What about the cases of the dead children or the women or men or gangs or, you know, drug busts or whatever other cases that happen by the gazillions every day? Why is it that case was the one? And frankly, when we came to find out that it was a hoax, we found out that it was effective use of the media. And while it was a hoax, how is it that the media have the egg on them?
No.
And why isn't it that we can't turn this huge platform of media and turn it into change? Now, there's some people that do it, like yourself and other people, but very, very, very far few between.
You know, and just the background noise there, it's fantastic. We're doing a crime show and we got the sirens going in the background. Or was that a fire truck?
No, it was actually a cop car, but...
Oh, great. Fantastic.
It sounded good.
Yeah, go good guys. Hopefully they're going to catch the bad guys. So, you know... Here you are, you're getting, that's the cop in me. You're getting an award or catching an award, whatever you want to call it, for the good work that you do and the report cards on the states you were talking about. But there's a bigger picture here, I believe, when it comes to consistency, when it comes to sentencing. You know, the McAvoy case, you and I have covered it many, many times. I hear yesterday that it's been delayed again the ninth time. Now until 2010, sometime. What needs to be done to fix that problem? 9-10 delays in a case, that's crazy.
Well, that's the exact issue, and that's the goal, actually, of an organization like First Start, to look at the systemic problems that exist within the system because of the parameters within the system. I mean, here you have a case where you have a defendant who has a right to a speedy trial. And, you know, I'm all about defendant's rights. I mean, I have to be a believer in the Constitution, and I am a believer in the Constitution, but give me a right break. The people of each and every state in this country have the right to a speedy trial, too, and victims have a right to speedy justice. And let me tell you, there's nothing that gets better with age, as we've talked about many, many times again. And frankly, it's incumbent on both the prosecutors and the courts to ensure that the victims' rights are met. And what makes me crazy is, why isn't it that the prosecutor and the judges aren't saying, hey, you know, defendant, it's time for your trial? What else could they possibly be waiting for? I mean, the victim in that case, you know, poor Becca, has been long since deceased at this point.
Yep.
Like, the actions and the sex crimes against her have happened long ago. Witnesses statements are not going to get better with time. The evidence is not going to get better over time. The only people who are prejudiced are the potential victims for the future and for the rest of us out here who are ensuring that justice is done. It's sickening.
Well said, as usual. Tell us, when will we see you on Joy Behar and Dr. Phil?
Dr. Phil airs on Thursday. I think it's at 3 o'clock on Pacific time, that I can say. And Joy Behar is tomorrow night. And, you know, then wherever I may fly by between then, you'll see me in between. But definitely via email. And, Dana, I just need to give you a big shout out for all of your work that you do. You really should be the recipient for all the awards that the rest of us receive, because you are the one who highlights the cases where there's so many injustices. So I give you my award because you really speak on behalf of victims.
Thank you, Robin. That means a lot. We'll talk to you again next week. Thank you.
Looking forward to it. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That's Robin Sachs. Check out her webpage at robinsachs.com, and congratulations to her on her most recent award for all the good work that she's done. Me, I'm just a show host. Wouldn't be much of a show if it wasn't for guests like Robin and, of course, you, the listener. That's it. That's tonight's show. We'll see you again real soon here on Scared Monkeys Radio.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.